Igor Stravinsky's 1919 ballet, The Firebird, was quick to become a classic. Why, then, in 1945, did Stravinsky write this version of it? The answer? Copyright. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
During the past 100 years in particular, few laws have spawned as much confusion and so many lawsuits as copyright laws. From movies based on the lives of private individuals to pop songs allegedly lifted from previous hits to college students getting sued for all those illegal downloads, copyright law affects all of us in one way or another, and it's been tested and developed through a lot of colorful court cases. Taking us through some of those cases is Anuj Desai, a professor of law at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Mark Twain, in his notebook of 1902, wrote that whenever a copyright law is to be made or altered, then the idiots assemble. Only one thing is impossible for God, to find any sense in any copyright law on the planet. Maybe we'll start with that. What is copyright law exactly, and why has it got such a bad rap, according to Mark Twain?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, copyright law is protection for creative goods, and that's it in a nutshell. And the protection is premised on a theory, one might say an economic theory, about the way in which creative goods are created. And the theory is basically that once you create something, it's very easy to copy. So as economists would put it, the cost to create the first copy is very high, what we would call the fixed costs of the initial creation, and then the marginal cost to create copies 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. is very low. And so the theory is if someone creates something and spends an incredible amount of time, effort, their own creative energy to create this first copy, and someone else can then willy-nilly make copies 2 through etc. and compete with them, then the second person can undercut the price that the first person would have to charge in order to recoup the initial investment, so to speak. And so the law gives this initial creator special, what are called exclusive rights, in order to prevent the second person or the, you know, what they sometimes refer to as the free rider from making copies of the initial work. But as Mark Twain points out, the operationalizing of this broad principle into the details of the law is incredibly complex. And I can just say that I think if I heard you right, it was 1902, 106 years later, it's a lot more complex than it was when Mark Twain spoke.
And you have the complexity going from national to international copyright laws too, I guess.
That's right. Now, literally, copyright law is all national. There are treaties, but the treaties regulate what the nations themselves can do. So the treaties don't actually create any law that affects individuals directly. But that's right. That is, the trade in creative goods, movies, music, etc., video games, across borders has created a lot of new complexities.
I went back to the Constitution just to check what it actually says, which
yes.
isn't much.
Yes,
but
it
in
isn't
that
much. That's
Article
right.
8 phrase, where it says, Congress shall have power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to the respective writings and discoveries. Well, that sounds as if it's covering both the copyright right, and also patents.
That's exactly right. So the reference to authors is a reference to copyright law, and the reference to inventors is a reference to patent law.
And where does intellectual property, that phrase, fit in then with copyright?
That's a great question. So copyright and patent law are considered to be species of intellectual property. So they both provide property rights to creators, authors, constitutional authors and or constitutional inventors. And so the phrase intellectual property tends to encompass all that and actually more, things such as trademark laws that protect the symbols and names, trade names of companies. And those laws tend to be consumer protection-oriented laws. They're designed specifically to protect consumers from confusion. And they, too, have become more complex in recent years. But those are all considered to be individual species of intellectual property.
And then where does trademark fit into all of that?
Right.
Those are protected also?
Right. So trademark does not come from the constitutional clause that Emily read. In fact, there was a case back in the 1880s, I believe, in which Congress tried to pass a trademark law and the Supreme Court invalidated it as exceeding congressional power.
Makes sense.
Under this clause. But trademark laws are now viewed as part of commercial intercourse. And so Congress can now pass trademark laws as, in essence, regulation of commerce. So they protect the commercial intercourse through protecting these particular marks and symbols and names that are meant to signify to consumers what's known as the source or the origin of the goods.
So the distinction is between who's being protected, whether it's the creator or the consumer.
To a large extent, that's right. That's right. I mean, the purpose of the law, that's right. I mean, in both cases, the rights, that is the legal rights, are given to, I don't say necessarily the creator, but the one who uses as opposed to the consumers. But that's right. Yeah, the basic premise of trademark law is consumer protection, which is very different from copyright.
On the sort of the other side, you hear phrases like fair use or public domain or whatever. And to look at what isn't copyright protected, can you tell us about the case, for example, with the phone books?
It's a great case. The basic idea behind copyright is to protect creativity. And in 1991, the Supreme Court had this case about whether or not a telephone book and all that's in it – and this is a White Pages, I should be clear.
Residential listings.
Residential listings, exactly. Name, telephone addresses would be protected by copyright law. And for a long time, there was an open question about whether or not copyright law might protect under what's called the labor theory, what they call a natural rights theory. Basically, if you work hard for something, you get protection for it. And the court there said no. The court, in essence, said the telephone book is not what's in the language of the law original enough or creative. It didn't have a sufficient modicum of creativity to merit copyright protection. And again, the idea is that we want to incentivize creativity. We don't necessarily want to incentivize hard work. And we may have other laws to incentivize hard work, but copyright law constitutionally, from the phrase that you read, has to protect a constitutional, quote, author. And an author, at least in the constitutional meaning, is someone who provides some slight amount of creativity.
Well, then why was there a case? I mean, with the phone book, if it went all the way to the Supreme Court?
Yes.
Yes. So what was the argument? In other words, what did the phone company claim?
And the phone company's claim was, in essence, a policy claim. As I said, before this case, it was an open question about whether this labor theory or this work hard theory and get protection was part of copyright law. And so the phone company made, in essence, a policy argument that mirrored or paralleled the argument for copyright in general. And that is, look, we need incentives to create this kind of thing, that is a database. And we know that they're actually valuable as in monetary terms because this other company came and copied our book.
To sell it.
In order to sell it. Now, the second company was actually doing sort of an agglomeration. These were all local telephone books, and the second company was creating a larger telephone book out of five or six different geographical areas. You know, this is back in the old days when local telephone companies, in essence, had a monopoly over local areas. And so it really was an open question at the time, and I think it's safe to say that most commentators at the time were surprised by the decision, in part because, again, the same kind of incentive argument can be made to for databases in general, even if you can't make it for this specific telephone book. I mean, it was the local telephone company that was using their own data that they really had to compile for their own purposes in any event, you know, to bill their customers and to do all the things that telephone companies do. But the general theory that it takes a lot of effort to create copy number one of a database and that being able to copy it for free seems unfair to the person who created number one still applied. So that's, you know, that was the basic argument.
Well, how much labor would be protected by a case in which somebody has some experience that would be of interest to the public in the form of a book or a movie, and then somebody else scoops them on it?
When you say experience, do you mind?
Well, let's say somebody that is in the news.
Yes.
I noticed you've mentioned this one case of a woman who was kidnapped and buried alive, and her story is of immediate interest to everybody.
Right, right.
But somebody kind of steals it out from under her.
Yes, yes. No, it was a great, great case. I mean, there are two parts to that. I mean, one is that what they call the black letter law, that is the crystal clear law of the circumstance, says that facts cannot be protected by copyright law. Now, what exactly is a fact then becomes the next natural next question. And in her circumstance, lots of things would be facts. So the fact that she had been kidnapped, the fact that she was buried alive, the fact – so those things would be fact and would easily be reportable certainly by newspapers. And so that really wouldn't be an issue. But one of the things that's quite interesting is that in that case, she co-wrote a book after the fact with the journalist from the local newspaper who had written a whole bunch of the stories. And the Universal City Studios then made a movie on the basis of that book.
That she co-authored.
That she co-authored. And so the question in those kind of cases always goes to what's known as the fact expression or idea expression distinction, that what she gets protection for is her expression. That is, the book contains lots of words written in her own voice, and that's what she theoretically has protection for. But none of the facts that she discloses in this book are protected.
So Universal Studios, why would they be that interested in her specific words? Why wouldn't they just build a movie on the facts?
That's exactly right. And that was their argument, and they actually won. So I mean, I shouldn't say they won, but they won on the, you know, sort of this question about whether or not she could get protection for
the facts of her
the
life.
The facts of her life, and whether the more actually probably more importantly, whether the journalist who co-wrote it with her could get protection for all of the, back to our labor theory, hard work that he had put into uncovering the story and covering it and finding out all the facts about the story that went into the book.
The answer to which would be no.
The answer to which in the end was no. That's correct.
So the research, the effort, none of that was protected.
None of that is protected. That's exactly right. The only thing that's protected, at least again in theory, I mean how it plays out in fact is often interesting.
That's right. Outcome with the copywriting of photographs is a long and interesting story.
Yeah, it also is. Yeah. Now, so photographs were first protected right around the Civil War, and Congress passed a law amending the then very sparse copyright law to provide for protection of photographs. And about 20 years later, a lithograph maker who made copies of someone's photograph, actually a very famous Napoleon Cerroni, who was a very famous photographer from the late 19th century, made copies of a photograph of Oscar Wilde.
Speaking of court cases.
Yes, exactly. That Cerroni had taken. The question, again, getting back to this fact-expression distinction, is what does a photograph represent? So for a long time, and you know, even today, you can sometimes think of a photograph as simply capturing reality.
Right.
Right? So there is an underlying reality, a factual reality, and the photograph simply captures it. And the reality, to the extent that there's a reality, you know, if you believe in God, God made the reality. Certainly the person who took the photograph isn't the author of the photograph.
So let's say we're seeing a sailor kissing a nurse Times Square.
Very famous photograph. Right.
V-day.
Exactly. So who –
just a fact. It just happened and he just happened to record
it.
But the arrangement of it, because that Oscar Wilde photo I've seen and he is posed a certain way.
That's
There's a background around him.
That's exactly right. And so in fact, part of what made the case – I don't want to say easy, but in retrospect, that particular case of a photograph very easy was that the photograph itself was a portrait. It was created – at some level, and therefore wasn't really a fact of nature created or the, you know, whatever the theory would be, created by God or whoever, but was in fact authored by Napoleon Cerroni. And you know, one of the things that's interesting about that case is that in those days, of course, the photographer wasn't the person who actually pushed the shutter. The photographer was simply the person who arranged, who did.
The director.
The director of a film. Exactly right. There's a cameraman and there's a director, as we would say today, for movies. And it was the exact same thing with photography then, that there was a director and that was the person who Napoleon Cerroni was. And he had an assistant who was the – and when Cerroni said, assistant, push the button, then the assistant pushed the button. Now, you know, the other interesting thing about that, of course, is – the pictures of Oscar Wilde, and anybody who knows Oscar Wilde would know that Oscar Wilde is not going to be told how to sit and what to wear and where, how exactly to sit.
Well, he has a very strong sense of aesthetics.
He claimed he was a work of art.
He was. Exactly. Exactly. And so one of the things that, you know, makes the whole question about photography interesting in this, you know, sort of narrow case of a portrait is – you could argue just as well that Oscar Wilde was the author of that photo, or at least parts of that photograph, because it was Oscar Wilde who set himself up in the way that Oscar Wilde wanted to be photographed. But the law ultimately has to choose, and so the law has decided that it's the photographer who gets the copyright in a photograph.
Even if I'm the one in the picture and he hasn't asked me for my permission?
Yes, is the short answer. There may be circumstances in which the taking of the photograph might violate other laws.
My privacy or
something or something of that sort. But under ordinary circumstances, that's right. If you're walking out down on State Street or Library Mall or somewhere in the public and a photographer comes and wants to take a photograph, they don't really need your permission in the most literal sense.
And how does that same logic apply then if I write a letter to somebody and they publish it? Who owns that letter that I send to you?
That's a great –
spilling out my most innermost thoughts.
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. Again, in terms of copyright law, the owner is the author. And so the person who wrote the letter owns the copyright to the letter. Now, one of the things that raises and one of the things that's so interesting about letters, at least, you know, not emails, but, you know, sort of original letters, is that there's a distinction between, you know, what the law refers to as the chattel or the physical manifestation of the copyrighted work, that is the physical letter, and the copyright rights in the letter. So the person who receives the letter owns – has some property right, owns the piece of paper that has the original writing on it, and yet the person who wrote the letter owns the copyright rights in the letter.
So you get to read it in the privacy of your own home, but you can't put it in the newspaper.
That's right.
Even if the author of that letter did not apply for a copyright, in other words, do you just sort of naturally?
Is it automatic?
That's a great question. Today, copyright protection for all kinds of works, and that's the case for all works created on or after January 1st, 1978. Before that, there was a big distinction between what are called unpublished works and published works. So the letters under ordinary circumstances would fall into the category of unpublished works, and those works, at least until 1978, were protected under what is called common law copyright, in essence. And in 1978, Congress, in essence, took away that perpetual common law copyright and put unpublished works and published works on the same footing. And they now all have copyright for what's known as life of the author plus 70 years.
So I don't need to write that little C in the circle when I sign my letter to you.
It's a very good question. Yeah, so literally you don't need to write the C in anything, actually, even in a book anymore, although the law provides a number of advantages related to burdens of proof about copyright ownership and things related to how much in terms of damages, how much money you can get if you do use the little C with a circle around it and the date and your name, right?
One of the most famous copyright cases involved the Beatle, George Harrison, and we're going to talk about music and copyright when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
The friendly, knowledgeable, and helpful people in our Audience Services Center are available to answer your program questions and take your comments. Call them at 1-800-747-7444.
Blues. So wrote George Harrison. That's all we can quote because of copyright. In a song that was a reaction to his experience in a copyright suit. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Anuj Asai. And we're looking at some fascinating and colorful cases which really today affect all of us and the way we deal with all kinds of art and fact. How did that case come about? Harrison was accused of lifting wholesale this song, He's So Fine.
Right. So not literally, of course, since the songs are different. And in fact, obviously, there's no copying of lyrics. And so the song is the Chiffons' big hit from the early 60s, He's So Fine, written by Ronald Mack. And the song that Harrison wrote is My Sweet Lord.
He's So Fine, My Sweet Lord. Right away, there's this kind of similarity in the sound of it.
If you know the tunes, that's exactly right.
Thank you.
in the end, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this case is that they didn't have any explicit evidence that Harrison copied. So now the theory of copyright law is that the only thing that constitutes infringement is if you copy someone else, not if you what's called independently create and the exact same thing.
Even after them. I mean, even if it can be demonstrated that they did it in 1963 and you're doing it in 1971.
Theoretically at least, even if you've done it afterwards, right? And again, part of the idea is that if you independently create something, not only is that not taking anything from the plaintiff, but that's in fact something we want to encourage because that's in fact part of what copyright law is designed to encourage. It's designed to encourage creativity. So if you independently are creative, why not? Not only would this not be infringement, but you would get your own copyright and then there would be two people that would have copyrights to this same thing.
Is the burden of proving that it's not independent on the plaintiff?
That is a great question. So the short answer is, in general, the burden in everything in law, when you don't know, the burden is on the plaintiff, I mean, is the general rule. And that's the case here. But you can see how if – let's put aside for a second if the, you know, the song is My Sweet Lord. Let's just say the song is He's So Fine and it really is identical. Then you can see why even if the burden to prove that the – person copied as opposed to independently created is on the plaintiff, it wouldn't be that difficult to convince someone that merely because of these similarities, the similarities themselves give rise to a presumption that you've copied, right? I mean, that would be the way the law
would
think about it. They're
so similar. One came after
the
other, clearly.
Exactly.
And in a fairly small pool of art.
And what the law requires is what's known as access, so that the plaintiff needs to prove that the defendant had access to the plaintiff's work.
That wouldn't be too hard in this case.
And in this case,
all
it's
over
easy.
The radio.
It's all over the radio. That's exactly right.
Wouldn't one of the things that an artist should have the right to do would be to use earlier artistic work to play with it, especially in music where you've got improvisation, taking an old tune and doing something different
or for satire,
responding
for that
to
matter.
It or I mean, so even if I would think just the way Shakespeare could make fun of earlier sonnets or use the form or, you know, tweak it or
it's a great question, and I'll just hold Norman's thought on the satire for a moment because we'll come back to that. But this question about what you can use to build upon, right, is one of the most fundamental questions in copyright because, again, remember back from the beginning, the whole point of the copyright law is to promote the creation of these kind of works, right, the creativity that presumably the law wants. And one can see just from the examples you're describing, at some point, if we give the plaintiff too many rights, too strong of a right, then we will, in essence, stifle the very creativity that the law is theoretically at least designed to promote, right? Now, that the question about where that line is a huge one and is always a difficult one. And in music, I mean, one of the things that often happens in these cases is that you will have experts. And the experts will come in and talk about how likely it is that someone could have independently created something, okay? Now, if you actually explicitly build on somebody else's work, the theory is, and we'll put aside for a second Norman's point about satire because we will come to that, but the theory at the very least is that for those purposes, you would need that person's permission, okay?
Now, so you can't do variations on a theme by or whatever without that person saying fine.
Without that person saying fine. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And many people think that's ridiculous, you know, just so we're clear, right? I mean, and what constitutes a variation on that theme and what constitutes effectively an independent work that has been inspired by that theme, let's say, is often where the law is drawing its lines. But, you know, the interesting thing in the George Harrison case is in the end, the similarities, if you, you know, and I'm not a musicologist, but I mean, you look at the similarities just as a layperson, and except for one, the basic melody, although similar, is almost trivial. I mean, you know, and again, this is not to diminish the worth of the song, both artistically and commercially, but it is to say that as a musical composition, it's not particularly sophisticated. And one of the things that happened in that case is that there is a repetition of the line four times. And in the fourth repetition, there is a grace note. And the court never says this explicitly, but you can see that it's not, you know, if it had been four times repeating this four-note theme, which is, as you probably know, not incredibly complex, I think you might well have had a different case. You literally might have had a different case.
Just,
but for that one
too many
note,
similarities, one too many
it was just
similarities.
One, I think one too many similarities, and a similarity that was what the law usually refers to as a striking similarity. Not a lot of similarity, but a striking similarity, meaning a similarity that you wouldn't expect, right? And I think the grace note, just having that little extra grace note, may well have been the straw that broke the camel's back.
And the intent wasn't an issue, right? Because they just the fact that a tune can simply come into your head without you knowing why it got there. In other words, George Harrison or I think Billy Preston is the one that wrote it down, right? Because if I remember right,
yes.
George Harrison didn't write music. But
right.
anyway, but
right.
if a tune came into your head, into your subconscious, that didn't matter for the purposes of the court.
Yes, and that was one of the interesting things about this case as a, you know, as a legal matter, putting aside the importance of it as a sort of cultural phenomenon, was that the judge in the end decided that although he didn't have any explicit evidence that Harrison intended to copy the chiffons or had explicitly copied, that the similarities were so great that he must have copied, but I, the judge, don't want to be in the position of saying that George Harrison actually copied the chiffons. And so, in essence, the court said that he had subconsciously copied the song. And you know, there was no denying that Harrison knew the song. And so that's how the court ended it.
Well, let's get back to that other question about not just satire, but any kind of really large-scale revamping of a song, which is acknowledged to be the inspiration for this second work.
That's where the law sort of, to be short about it, has no clear answers whatsoever. I mean, that of course means you know, full employment for copyright law professors and copyright lawyers. There's a very famous case also involving music that went to the United States Supreme Court about 15 years after the George Harrison case. And it involves a very famous old 60s tune that Roy Orbison sang called Pretty Woman.
Sure, big hit.
And it was a big hit, and there was even a movie that used it as
many
a
years
theme,
later,
theme
yes.
song many years later. Right. And the rap group, Two Live Crew, did a rap version of the song, and they changed all the words. And the owner of the copyright sued Two Live Crew and the author of this rap version of the song. And the question, of course, is, as you say, this rap version is not the same. You could think of it as just inspired by at some level. And if all it had was inspired by, then at least in the law, that would be a very easy infringement case. You're taking my music, you're putting it in a new form, but it's clearly my song. There is, and this I'm sure many listeners have heard of, there is a doctrine in copyright law called the fair use doctrine
yes.
that allows for uses of copyrighted works. And that was the doctrine that the Two Live Crew defendants argued allowed them to use Orbison's song. And the basic rationale was this. What Two Live Crew had done was not simply take Orbison's song and put it into rap. What they had instead done was created a version of the song that mocked the original.
Right.
Okay, that criticized the original. So the words of the original are all basically about how wonderful it is to see a woman and find her beauty, just her surface beauty, and how wonderful it is. You don't know anything else about her. You just see her, and all of a sudden, all these wonderful things will happen. And the Two Live Crew version has a very different take on what it means to see a woman and not know who she is and where she's from and what her origins are and what would happen if you actually ended up getting together with her, okay? And so the argument was that the Two Live Crew version was a mock of the view about the world that the original was expressing, this view that we can live in this airy-fairy fairy tale world, okay? And so it was again, seen as a criticism, as a direct criticism of the original.
Actually damaging to the original song.
Damaging to the original song. That was the theory. And so analogous to the theory went a critical theater review, for example. Right.
Right.
So when we have, say, a critical theater review or a critical book review, and the book review, you know, reviewer says, this person is a lousy writer. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm. It was a dark and stormy night.
Exactly, right. And gives a long excerpt, right? And then says, isn't this just terrible, right? And then explains more, let's say. In those circumstances, we say the fair use doctrine is doing exactly what we want the copyright law to do. That is, we want to allow criticism. Because, you know, in part as because criticism we think of as a culturally important phenomenon.
Making these things known and evaluating them for public use.
For public purposes, right, exactly. And there are also what we would call sort of First Amendment or free speech values that start coming in. If I can be sued for criticizing someone, right, then it starts feeling like that person is suppressing my speech. I'm trying to get out a criticism of this person, and you're suppressing me.
So if George Harrison had written he's not fine,
yes,
or, no, had somehow turned the song around, it would have been all right.
That's the theory, yes.
So right. Two Live Crew won or lost that one?
So Two Live Crew, most people view it as a victory. They didn't literally win. They ended up settling. But the Supreme Court explicitly did hold that you can consider, when considering the fair use doctrine, you can consider what is known as parody, not satire. And mm-hmm. I'll give you an explanation of the distinction in a second,
oh boy.
Or at least the legal distinction between the two in a second. But the idea was that because parody takes the original and uses the original in a way to criticize the original.
Right.
That is something that the fair use doctrine allows. Right. And again, okay. I may have overstated that because the fair use doctrine is this multi-factor doctrine that every case must be determined on its individual basis. But the basic argument was that because this was a parody, that would be a strong reason to consider it as a fair use, right. And the distinction is between parody and satire is, at least legally, is that satire, you're using the original to criticize something other than the original. So let me give you an example. There's a famous case involving the Cat in the Hat. Someone wrote a story called The Cat is Not in the Hat. And it was not a parody of Dr. Seuss's original. What it was a satire of the O.J. Simpson trial.
Sure.
So he used
the form.
Mm-hmm. And, it was all this thing about the glove is not, where is the glove or whatever it is, sort of thing. But the idea was it was using it, again, to make a commentary on an important social issue, the O.J. Simpson trial, But
just playing on the familiarity of the original.
Playing on the familiarity of the original. But again, the court said that is a satire, not a parody, because it's mocking something other than the original work.
Is that fair use?
And that was not fair use.
That was not fair use.
I wonder then, because I just saw at Borders sitting out in display a book called Goodnight Bush, using the, you know, children's book, including the way the illustrations are, but all about oil refineries and Dick Cheney. So that would be
instead
satire,
of Goodnight Moon.
Right, instead of Goodnight Moon. But that would be in that Cat in the Hat category.
That would be in the Cat Not in the Hat category.
Yeah. All right.
That's right.
So when Weird Al takes Michael Jackson's song Beat It and turns it into Eat It, I mean, right down – I mean, the brilliance of Weird Al is that he is right down to the note and the phrase and the breath, copying the original but putting his own words to it, which parody – right? The original.
That's right.
Do you have to pay for that or is it for use?
Weird Al is a very interesting example. And I have to admit, I don't know all the details, but I can say this much, that as a legal matter, that is certainly not fair use. Okay. It very likely, though, that this is where the sort of real world of the, you know, what we'd call the sort of the sociology of law that comes in. And that is, if you're Michael Jackson, do you want to sue Al Yankovic, right? The answer is no.
Because it makes you look like
a stick in the mud.
Yeah.
It makes you look like an idiot.
Can't take the humor.
Right. And so now it could be that he has permission for some of those, but I don't think so. I suspect that it's partly because he has already himself a certain stature that allows him to get away with things that the rest of us probably couldn't get away with. Now, and part of it is because he does it well.
Yes, he does it so well, sure.
But I think a lot of it is just the sort of realpolitik of how ridiculous a major artist would look if they brought that suit.
Well, and speaking of ridiculous, what about the idea of forbidding camps from singing Puff the Magic Dragon and a whole lot of other songs? I mean, there was an attempt to get...
There was. Right. That's exactly right. The Girl Scouts, right, were sent letters.
And the logic being?
So there the logic is that, and this is a little bit different. Let me back up. One of the rights that the copyright owner has, other than what's called the right of reproduction or the sort of traditional copyright right, is what's called the right of public performance. And so the question... In that, you know, if that case were ever to come to a court, is whether or not a performance, that is a singing of these songs around the campfire,
constitutes a public performance.
It clearly is a performance. And the question is whether it counts as a public performance. And you'd be amazed at how the law in some circumstances has defined public incredibly broad ways. There's a famous case involving these video rental places that used to have rooms in the back. So you could basically take the videotape into the back room and they'd sell popcorn and they'd sell candy and Coke. And
is that public performance?
And does that constitute a public performance? I mean, you're in the room with, you know, two other people, but it's the video store that is performing. And the court said that that was a public performance.
Well, but in terms of the damage, I mean, do you have to demonstrate that this will damage you? Does Paul Stuckey have to demonstrate that the campfire girl singing Puff the Magic Dragon is somehow damaging to his reputation or income?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, literally no. So that is, in copyright, in contrast to a lot of other areas of law, damage is presumed if infringement is shown. So if you show that somebody has actually copied something, you can get what are known as statutory damages, which basically allow the court to award somewhere between $750 and $30,000 per work copied, even if you don't show any literal damage.
Okay? Oh, just a kind of a baseline damage.
Right. Because the theory goes damages are hard to prove.
Sure.
That's the theory.
Is some of it that artists – it's hard to make a living sometimes as an artist? I mean, is some of it to protect the right to make money in whatever way it could be found?
Right. I think some of it is this idea that if you copy something, you know, in lots of circumstances, we might just take the Girl Scouts singing around the campfire, right? There's no damage from the standpoint of impacting some independent market for the sale of your work, right? And so the law says, because it's very hard to prove what you would have charged for this, we're going to assume something. And, you know, again, you might just say it seems a little ridiculous. For example, you know, these downloading cases today,
yes,
right? You know, again, once the recording industry proves that you have uploaded or downloaded a single song, that's a minimum of $750, okay? Once, you know, if you get all the way to court, right? In the meantime, we all know that the value of it is 99 cents.
Because right? you can buy it for that online, legitimately.
From iTunes, right, okay? And so there's, you know, there seems to be this huge mismatch, right?
Distribution can be part of that, too, if you're copying it and sending it out to 100 friends.
Absolutely.
That's $100 per title.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, and in fact, if you can prove particular damages, specific damages, then you can choose if you want to get the specific damages rather than $750 to $30,000, right? So if somebody makes 500,000 copies of your song and distributes them, right, you're not limited to this $750 to $30,000 range. But again, you know, the sort of the basic premise is that it's hard to prove. And I think, Emily, you're right, that some of it goes back to a view that copyright owners are entitled to something. You know, you referred, of course, to the artists, but again, the sort of political economy of music distribution suggests that it's not clear that the artist is going to be getting a huge amount from, depends which artist, obviously, but from these proceeds.
There's always this question then of, is it worth pursuing? Is it worth pursuing in terms of the economics of it and the image?
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. We were talking earlier about Al Yankovic, but there was another case recently in which a woman had her home, and I don't remember the details, but a homemade video of her toddler dancing to a Prince song, or an artist formerly known as Prince song.
Unpronounceable artist.
Unpronounceable. And was sent a takedown
cease and desist
letter on, again, the theory that someone could listen to his song on YouTube. And, you know, if you listen to this, I mean, very quickly this became, as you suggest, a public relations fiasco and they withdrew it. But I did hear this, I mean, watch this YouTube, you know, it's 2.5 minutes long and it's, you can barely hear it. I mean, it's unbelievable. But again, I think part of it is some artists are very concerned about protecting their image and anything that undermines their image. And the theory was if somebody searches for this song, they might get this.
And then
they're going to hear this bad version of my song.
Right.
Right. And so a lot of it does have to do, you know, partly, I guess you could say, with the economics of it, but partly with control.
How much does maintenance have to do with the validity of a copyright? In other words, if I'm Prince and I send out a cease and desist to the toddler or even sue the toddler, but it can be demonstrated that the last 100 times that other people have done this over the years, I have not pursued it. I have not maintained my copyright. How much does that cut?
That's a good question. I mean, in literal terms, as long as you own the copyright, it doesn't matter. The short answer to the question is you don't have to maintain in any way your copyright.
So you don't have to worry about it going, say, public domain just because you haven't called people on it.
That's exactly right. It used to be the case that, if you remember, I mentioned that before 1978, there were unpublished works and published works. And if you had a published work, you would have to register your copyright and you'd have to put the little C on there. And you basically had – the terms varied over time, but towards the end of the time, you had basically two 28-year terms. And you were required at year 28, in essence, to renew it or else it would go into the public domain. So there were circumstances in the past in which things might have gone into the public domain because of a failure on the part of the copyright owner. But again, for works that have been created since January 1st, 1978, there's no maintenance necessary.
What kind of issues are you watching right now where you think it's sort of new questions coming up with the many different media, all the different technologies? What are you watching right now that you think will kind of push things along?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's so many. One of the things I love about the subject is there's so many things going on all the time, and it's really ultimately about the intersection between culture and technology. And as technology advances, it shapes culture and what role the law plays in the middle there. The big thing that's going on our campus and has been for the last few years is this question about these downloading cases. And one of the things that's interesting about it is legally, they're actually – most circumstances, they're actually very easy, right? I mean, most of the time when – you know, the Joe average college student is downloading music using a peer-to-peer file sharing network without going through one of the paid services like iTunes or Rhapsody, that person is infringing on the copyright owner's rights. But there's a very interesting question. In part, you remember I said this question about the damages. You might wonder, how does the music industry find these people, right? You know, some people get caught, some people don't get caught. Well, it turns out that the way they find these people is they find them by themselves going on these peer-to-peer networks and themselves downloading. They hire an expert who goes and downloads. Okay,
of course.
So the only people they actually catch so far are people who upload, not people who download. Okay. So if you're only downloading and not uploading – you're very likely not going to be caught because it's technically much more difficult to find you. And the theory is that people will always be selfish. They'll always want to download. But if we can use the law to impact the people who are presumably being selfless, well, it turns out that when they catch these people who upload, right, they usually just will download from them, you know, a handful of songs, say a dozen. But at the same time, what they'll do is they'll effectively take a digital photograph of – not literally a photograph, but a digital photograph of the files that are available. Okay? And why do they do that? They do that because they want to know how many files there are, okay, and which files there are. So they say, look, I only downloaded from you 10 songs, but I looked at that file folder, right? And I noticed that you had 1,000 songs that were available, right? So I'm going to hit you and sue you for all 1,000.
For each instance.
For each instance. But again, it's each instance of a song that you have on your computer, not necessarily a song that was ever downloaded or uploaded from your computer, right? And it seems like this incredibly technical thing, but for huge numbers of college students, it's a huge amount of money. Because if you think about it, they download 10 songs. Well, you know, $7,500 is bad, but I got 1,000 songs. And if they're claiming that they can sue me for all 1,000, you know, my homeowner's insurance isn't going to be paying for this anymore, right? And so literally the question is whether or not making available a song constitutes copyright infringement. And yet for lots of people, it's a huge, huge issue because it'll affect how much money they have to shell out.
It sounds as if it's going to take a while to sort that one out. And of course, you'll have to come back and update us.
Sure.
If for no other reason than to bring to us some more of these colorful cases.
I'd love to.
Just touched on a few of those. Anuj Desai has been our guest this hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. This program, copyright 2008 by the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.